are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au. A church can be diminished by trying to be too inclusive or on trend. A pulpit can be diminished by what it doesn't say or won't talk about in an effort to alienate no one. In UU churches, especially theologically, our desire for inclusiveness manifests itself as a kind of default position of generalized atheism, or at least a pose of know-nothing agnosticism to hide it. That's kind of the strike zone for this public worship we're doing, allowing for God and no God to coexist peacefully in our sanctuaries, like identical twins safe in one womb. And on the whole, that coexistence between God and no God is probably no bad thing. But when it comes to offering any solid basis for moral choices, this theological inclusiveness can be a problem, because the fruit of our roomy theological womb is often the underdeveloped offspring known as moral relativism, the idea that in the great scheme of things, there's no absolute right or wrong ordained from above or inherent in the nature of things. Still, let's allow that. Morals are temporal, local, negotiable, so we're on our own down here, and it ultimately doesn't much matter what we do to each other. Any ideas we have about morality or meaning are just like our opinion, man. So let's allow that. It doesn't finally matter what we do to each other or to the planet. The universe will continue on, as it always has, doing whatever it is it's doing. Doesn't matter if down here we rob each other, enslave each other, rape each other, kill each other, or just break the planet all to pieces. But, you know, we don't live as though there is no firm moral order, nor can we imagine living without it. For if we were to actually live as if there was no moral order, our human existence would be even more brutal and anarchic than history shows it has been for most of human existence. I mean, life can scarcely be worth living if life itself doesn't, in some absolute and abiding sense, matter. So the greatest moral challenge of our times is not whether there's a God or not, but how we think about morality itself, without recourse either to dogma or to an anything-goes moral relativism. Now, the reading I offered you from Marilynne Robinson makes a compelling case for a basis for moral living, one that does not require a God to validate or endorse or enforce it, namely, that life is objectively better than lifelessness. Consciousness, conscious being, is rarer and more precious than non-being. So it would follow from that that those behaviors that nurture life, whether it be a human life or the life on this lovely, lonely planet, are objectively good, and those that don't nurture life are not. Now, of course, this is not the end of moral discussions and decision-making, of course. There'll always be priorities to make. But the difference between life-rendering and death-dealing does give us a firm foundation upon which to guide our steps. Because we have to take steps in this world. We have to make decisions every day about how we impact others and the world. As much as we'd like to just retreat into our quiet center, pull up the drawbridge, and pretend that the effects of our behavior don't extend any further than our nose. But they do. And we kind of know that they do. We just sort of push our moral agency to the periphery of our awareness of the web of life so that we can get on with our lives, get on doing what everybody else seems to be doing so we can remain safe and accepted. It's so commonplace. We push our moral agency to the periphery every time we put our slave labor smartphone into the pocket of our sweatshop jacket or handbag. Best not to focus too much on the webbiness of life, eh? But this is Mother's Day, a day when we are called to honor mothering in all its forms. And there are many forms. Tenderly bearing life in the womb, of course, but mothering also in surrogacy, stepmothering, fostering, adopting, mentoring, teaching, healing. Mothering can rightly be said to be inclusive of all those things that anyone, regardless of gender or fertility, can do to nurture life and help it flourish on this lovely, lonely, blue-green earth, which is the mother of us all. In a cosmos mostly lifeless, how precious is the nurturing of fragile, fleeting life. How holy. To awaken our hearts to that mothering nature and nurture we are all capable of, regardless of gender, regardless of fertility, regardless of whether you're a mother or not, or have one, let us sing together the following hymn. Please stand as you're able. So having awakened your hearts, if we can affirm with head and heart that the nurturing of life is a real moral absolute, part of the nature of reality, and a firm foundation to guide our steps to live rightly in this world, would we, could we, should we actively support or passively benefit from destroying life, from choosing lifelessness over life? Let me illustrate with something about as diametrically opposed to a nurturing womb as I could legally lay my hands on. This little phallic demon is a 17th century short sword. It dates from about 1650 to 1675. It's one of a collection I have. This is probably the most lethal edged weapon ever made, the evolutionary high point of edged weaponry. I know it doesn't look like much relative to the massive broadswords you see on Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings, but trust me, this little guy would prevail any day against any other edged weapon. I do happen to know a little bit about edged weapons and their history. I've worked in a rather specialized field as a historical stage fencing practitioner and director for theater and opera, and you may remember the cognitive dissonance you felt seeing this incongruous image in the newspaper a few years back when I was directing sword fights for Don Giovanni at State Opera. In fact, I was working on a PhD years ago, but abandoned it, on how to make stage violence more effective. I wanted audience reactions to staged violence to be shock and horror, to make them as viscerally sick and disgusted by staged mayhem as they would be if they were to witness a stabbing in real life. I wanted to create a way of doing staged violence that repelled the audience. It didn't work out. Turns out you can't fool them into thinking it's real. So this deceptively named small sword was deadly on purpose. It was the result of the focused intentions of centuries of designers, scientists, and engineers. As you see, it tapers elegantly to a fine point for ease of insertion. It's as easy as inserting a hypodermic needle. And of course, since it's tapered, the wound gets bigger as the blade goes in. And look, This is a triangulated blade. It has three cutting edges and, helpfully, a gutter to allow the blood to flow forth from the wound unimpeded by the blade itself, and so it doesn't create a seal around the insertion point. The gutter allows the blood to flow out of the womb, as the woodcut demonstrates, under the victim's own blood pressure, so the victim bleeds out faster. And this blade is tempered to be rigid, made with the finest available carbon steel, so this little needle can pass through the toughest tissue, even solid bone. And it's very light and well-balanced, so it can be wielded at the speed of thought. The wound it creates is not a mere slit, which is easily sewn up by anybody like a seamstress or a valet, but a triangular wound that won't close by itself, and so requires the work of a skilled surgeon to prevent bleeding out. Now, in duels, in battles, in street melees, trained surgeons were seldom at hand, so the wounds that were meant to be caused by this lightning-fast, razor-sharp, rigid, nasty little sidearm were usually mortal wounds. So the point of all that thoughtful design, that skilled engineering, that high and expensive technology, is to render someone lifeless. But they're so sexy. I've never met anyone that didn't want to handle one of these and maybe swing it around like D'Artagnan. But technology has made weapons even sexier than these. We now live in a fascinating modern age where flying killer robots are a reality. That's a drone. Thanks to GPS, infrared, and facial recognition, Lockheed and Boeing can literally find anyone anywhere on the planet and deliver a laser-guided missile to blow them to paste, and whoever happens to be nearby. The Israeli Defense Force, Australia's partners in peace, have developed a clever gun to shoot Palestinians around corners, lest soldiers get hit by rocks. And who knows when these lovable robot clowns at Boston Dynamics will be marching down someone's street, armed, indestructible, and unstoppable. These technological advances have become so irresistibly cool that they are a huge global business. The more people acquire advanced arms, the more others want them to defend against them. As a business model, it is sheer bloody genius. And so it's no surprise that our beloved country wants to join in, turning a large chunk of our collective research, engineering, and technology, those beloved STEM courses, towards getting in on this lucrative market with the stated aim of making our country one of the top 10 arms dealers in the world. Now remember, the point of all such arms, like the point of this sword, is to take the life of strangers with the greatest possible ease, efficiency, and certainty. Inherent in the design of all armaments is the opposite of nurturing life. Life-taking is built in. It's a defining feature of them. There are no benign ones. Therefore, morally, if the nurturing of life is indeed precious in this vast, cold, and seemingly lifeless cosmos, we might therefore have a firm and rational moral foundation to say that the making and selling of arms is indeed immoral, not in opinion, but in truth. Now, I lack the rhetorical skills to fully skewer the stupidity of this push to arm the world. So to lighten the mood, here's what some really clever writers had to say about our government's push towards Australia's mothering arms.
It's worth doing well, it's worth doing yourself. That's why I have a self-managed super fund, because I'm in control of my future.
Yeah, you think you are.
Now that we have a seat at the Human Rights Council, we'd like to announce our plan for making the world a better place. Selling arms. That's right, our Minister for Offence has just launched the Australian Military Sales Catalogue, full of all your basic essentials for murdering, maiming and blowing up humans. Guns, ammo, rockets, need a tank, we've got it, and so much more.
I need war hats. us.
But don't worry, we'll only sell weapons to our friends and allies, like Saudi Arabia, which is currently slaughtering thousands in Yemen, triggering a massive cholera outbreak. It's also the world's leading sponsor of terrorism. But that didn't stop our Piney from going there to make some sweet deals. Or Indonesia, which needs all the help it can get from us to carry out its ongoing genocide in West Papua. And the Philippines, where Aussie-made guns might one day be used by this maniac to shoot women in the wait, what the
Piney's war hatch!
It's all part of our death policy, to turn Australia into one of the world's top 10 exporters of arms, so Australia can profit directly from escalating wars, which in turn will create more refugees to whom we can turn our backs when they flee to our shores. It's a perfect plan. That's why we're investing $200 billion into debt, most of which will go to offshore defence contractors, who just happen to be some of our most generous donors. Why didn't we invest that money into our car manufacturing industry, or into renewables, or into medical research to prevent dementia, the second leading cause of death in Australia? The answer, of course, is that here at the Australian government, we're a bunch of seriously... Why, we're not only planning to export arms, Dutto's also trying to change our laws so we can have more guns inside Australia. And if you don't like it, well, you're dead to him. Boom! So what you waiting for? As Piney says...
Do yourself a favour and go out and get the military sales catalogue.
Piney's war hatch!
Lowest morals are just the beginning. Authorised by the Department for blowing up people whose orphan children will later deny a refugee visa. Unless they're white South African farmers.
Nothing like a little chuckle to let us off the hook. Look, if you think it's incongruous to refer to such things on the day we celebrate motherhood, you're right. But this is the sort of cognitive dissonance we live with and that's making us crazy. Being encouraged by our culture, on the one hand, to value life-nurturing motherhood in all its forms, and on the other, to be blithely okay with dealing out arms to create lifelessness on a global scale. But if life is indeed better than its absence, we do not need to be bewildered by the cognitive dissonance of our culture if we can locate and affirm a few basic moral values. Now, church is meant to offer something in the way of guiding moral direction, and its role and relevance can be diminished by the guidance that it doesn't offer. The early abolitionist preachers, many of whom were Unitarians in decrying the slave trade, assumed that in a republic, every adult person is capable of asserting influence and is thus, to some degree, responsible for the laws and policies enacted in their name. If a church, by its silence, validates its people's participation in the global arms trade, and thus acts as if life is no better than its absence, that church has lost any functioning moral compass, and had really better close up shop, particularly those churches which hold up as a moral exemplar that annoying Galilean prophet depicted on our stained glass windows. You may remember that when armed troops came to the Mount of Olives to arrest him, Jesus knew, as everybody did, that soldiers meant at the very least a good ass-kicking, and quite possibly meant his life. In a panic, Jesus' best mate Peter, who later became the first pope, drew a sword and hacked off the ear of one of the soldier's servants, who was unarmed. How brave! Amazingly, with all the soldiers present and Peter cutting off ears, an OK Corral-type bloody melee did not ensue. And it didn't ensue because the man on our window was quick to intervene, admonishing his friend by saying, "Put away your sword." Do you not know that all who live by the sword shall perish by it? Which is less to say that there's some kind of magic justice that's going to punish all the violent, but more to say something that the great Earth Mother herself knows. Are you going to reap what you sow? That the best defense against violence is not to enact it. Don't warmonger, maybe. Don't invade other people's spaces. Don't spread around more fiendishly clever and sexy weapons around the place, but instead, perhaps work to create understanding and ease tensions between people. Give generous aid to those driven to violent despair. Nurture life and the living world, and the life and peace you sow will be returned to you. That's more what he meant, I think. As we and others like Dr. King and Gandhi have inherited moral direction from Jesus' nonviolence, The Galilean himself took seriously the moral direction he had inherited from the books of those wacky visionaries, the Jewish prophets, who said, "He will judge between nations and will settle disputes for many people. He will beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation will not take up sword against nation, nor will they train for war anymore." Such prophetic words, I'm betting, were already ancient when Isaiah said them. In feeling the necessary truth of such words, we see our humanity from a perspective not unlike a God's. Feeling how fragile and precious is life, we become keenly aware that we ourselves are not eternal, and thus are experiencing our very fullest humanity, an ability to know truths far beyond our immediate pocketbooks and needs and circumstances, and to ponder the meaning of our existence itself. We have, in our nature, the impulse to cherish and nurture life, a mothering impulse, if you will. And that mothering impulse comes at no small cost to the self, as any mother will tell you. And that kind of self-sacrifice, though, happens every day, and it happens consistently and powerfully enough to show a human wisdom that is exceptional in all of living nature. Together, of course, with 1,000 other of our passions that make us cruel, cheap, harsh, and sometimes catastrophically stupid. We shall beat swords into plowshares, not because God says so, but because we know we must. Because we know life is better and needs our self-giving nurture. So this Mother's Day, let us then make our call to arms a call to the mothering arms of nurturing the rare and precious commodity of life in this vast and lifeless expanse we float in, safe for now, in the womb of our only mother, the great, sweet, lovely, living Mother Earth. Amen.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.